This week on the program, we rewrite history. Yes, Viking history. Not only did the men fight in battle, but it now turns out that women fought alongside them. This was not just shield maids holding their shields and their armaments. We now have proof through the burials in Sweden that women were trained and fought along with men. This is something that has not been documented. This is brand new data, and it really shows that our understanding of the ancient past, again, has been presented from a narrow perspective. This is a brand new look at how the men and women of the Vikings fought in a martial culture, a culture of warring. And today's guest will present it to us in startling detail. All this in the news today on Earth Ancients. Saturday, August 28th, 2021, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Earth Ancients, and I hope you're doing well today. Hey, my suffering is over. I've been suffering through the federal United States government's lack of expediency in processing my passport. I've been dealing with issues with my passport now since I was denied boarding a plane back in May to go to Egypt, which those of you who are listening that were on that tour, I have to tell you, I was devastated. And I immediately sent my passport in to get it renewed, even though I had 5 months left on it. And in the process, I was told that it would take 18 weeks plus another 4 to 6 weeks for it to return via mail. Things are so backed up right now on the federal side. Here in San Francisco, the federal building, you're not allowed to get in there unless you have an appointment. You can't get an appointment. There's no appointments available. So long story short, I had to pull the big guns, and I, at the suggestion of a friend who works in the movie industry, I went to the local senator here, who is Barbara Lee in Oakland. It's a few miles south of where I'm located. And they were able to expedite my passport, or I would not be able to go to Mexico in October, let alone any place else this year. I have a friend whose passport took almost 9 months to get after he submitted it late last year. And there's no way I can go anywhere. You have to have a passport when you leave our country, the United States. So I just want to say, I want to thank Barbara Lee, Senator Lee, and her team for expediting, helping the federal department, the agency understand that I needed to get to Mexico in October. So it is a great relief. I am overjoyed, and I am sending her staff a big box of See's chocolates. If you don't know See's chocolates, it's the best candy coming out of California. It's handmade. It's amazing. So I am just so relieved and gratified that this can happen. I feel for others, though. I'm in the process of getting my son a passport, and thankfully he can't join me in Mexico, but I'm hoping that he can join me in Egypt in May of 2022. So that's happy ending to a strenuous procedure and story of passport renewal. I don't have a clue about people trying to get new passports right now because you just can't get a hold of anything. Everything's closed. So that is good news. Hey, this week we got a different format. We're changing the lanes a little bit. We have a presentation by the engineer Chris Dunn. Chris Dunn is the author of Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt and his best-known book, The Giza Power Plant. He's going to talk a little bit about what he discovered from the video that Manu Seisvedet presented on ancient architects on this northern shaft in the Great Pyramid, the Great Khufu Pyramid. And, of course, Chris has studied it, that structure, for over 25 years, actually going on 30 years. And he has a new book coming out, and we'll hear about this book next year, early next year. He's almost done with it. We'll learn about it shortly. So Chris is going to replace Bruce Fenton, our science editor, this week. Bruce will be back with us next Saturday, September 4th, on all things ancient and unusual. But today we want to hear from Chris Dunn on what has been discovered in this northern shaft. We wanted to follow up and get more details from somebody who has dissected the Great Pyramid and understands more about this debris in the northern shaft of the Great Pyramid, which sits above the Queen's Chamber. Had a chance to go in the Queen's Chamber a couple of years ago, and the whole structure, the whole pyramid, is just mind-blowing. It's just this huge edifice that was created, as Chris believes, as a power plant. Others have different theories, but it's mechanical in many, many ways. And it's dumbfounding that our Egyptologists still believe it's a great tomb. It's just no evidence of a tomb. No a body was never found. No offering goods or trinkets were ever discovered in any part of the shafts, of the rooms, the king or queen's chamber, the great corridor, the subterranean chamber, which I've been to. It just defies logic. And when we look at these great and ancient buildings, we have to look at them. We have to expand our thinking. We can't present them from our own science and technology because they exceed that. And you when you go to Egypt and you see these very, very old buildings that were constructed by some other means than we understand, then it makes sense that there was another science and technology involved to construct them. So Chris is going to present a little look, like 10, 15 minutes of his dissection of what Manu Seisvedet has presented. I want to also mention that there's been some confusion regarding destiny, and destiny is not for everybody. Destiny is every Wednesday, and it follows similar format, but destiny is covering esoteric ancient sciences. We have a program on yoga. The next program is on meditation. These are like a lot of Eastern sciences, Eastern philosophies that have crept into the Western society. Yoga is everywhere now, but 20 years ago, it was like, what? What's yoga? You know, I mean, people really didn't know about it. So if you're not interested in the esoteric stuff, just don't turn destiny on. Don't listen to it. But the proof is in the pudding. We have a pretty good audience listening to these programs. And I enjoy doing them because there is so much data out there that's not getting to enough people. And so that's one of the reasons I created Destiny. It also allows for things that are not fitting for Earth Ancients. And so those of you who are not happy that it's on the same feed, it's unique. Now, remember, podcasting is still in a wild, wild west. So it's pretty much anything goes. And so I'm doing something that many would feel is unorthodox. It's a podcast within a podcast in many ways. Destiny will have its own Facebook page. We're currently working on a new website that'll have Destiny material. But I have to say, when we do our tours, either the Mexico, Peru, Egypt, Europe, wherever, the material that we feature on Destiny is many times fitting, especially when it comes to having a sense of the subtleties of these ancient buildings, temples, and pyramids. The elders who I worked with in the Maya community, as well as others in different parts of the world, were all about subtle earth energy, things we call ley lines. And a lot of these buildings are built over center points or convergent points of ley lines, which are telluric fields as energy bubbles up. Well, they figured out a way to capture it. And so when you're in these places, like my most favorite is Uxmal and the Great Pyramid there, you actually can feel a subtle, very low vibration, a hum almost. When we go to Hathor Temple in Dendera in Egypt, when you walk on those megalithic floors, people always say to me, why does it feel like I'm stepping on electricity, or I'm stepping on some kind of vibrational field? Well, in different parts of that building, the place is turned on. I mean, it's an energetic field that is passing through the bowels of that place. So I have a technique called plugging into ancient buildings, temples, and pyramids that I show people how to use. And we'll have it in Mexico. We'll have it in Egypt. And this is what destiny is all about. And it's really not appropriate for Earth Ancients. So destiny is a welcome addition. It's a sister to Earth Ancients. And I hope you enjoy the material. It looks like most people are. But if you don't like that, just don't listen. Don't turn on Earth Ancients Destiny on Wednesday. That's just a little clarification. I really enjoyed our interview today with Nancy Marie Brown and her book on the Valkyrie, who until recently were thought of as shield maidens of the Vikings. And she has done just some outstanding research into the grave sites that they have found in Sweden, and has rewritten the entire narrative on the culture of the Vikings, how women were indoctrinated into a lifestyle that was, for all purposes, a warring culture, and they were with men in fighting. Now, we hear a lot about the Amazons that the Greeks chronicled, and there's some new books coming out that we'll feature here on the actual real Amazons. It was not a myth. The Amazons were actually a fighting force in early Greek history. So we're getting a new narrative. We're getting a new idea on the women's role in these ancient societies. And what really is wonderful to hear and understand is the term martial society or martial culture. These are terms used for a civilization that went to war regularly, and they trained the men and women to be warriors, something we're just not familiar with. And she writes, I should say, she rewrites the book on the Vikings and how women were right alongside men in battle, which is just unheard of. And it's all based on this gravesite that was revealed a couple of years ago that most people don't know about, simply because it is not being reported, and it changes our understanding of the ancient past. And I love it. What Nancy presents today is profound on so many levels. So quite a show for you today. Ago, the YouTube channel Ancient Architects featured a video by Chris Dunn. And for those of you who don't know who Chris Dunn is, he is the author of The Giza Power Plant and my favorite book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. And I refer to Chris quite a bit, and you've probably heard me talk about his work, his research on this podcast. And he recently posted a video on this northern shaft above the Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid in Giza Plateau. And I have Chris on here with me to talk a little bit about what he feels the importance of the shaft is, and perhaps its contribution in the overall structure of the Great Pyramid. So, Chris, welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Cliff. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about what you feel the importance of this shaft is. Manu Saizvadeh had a video. We had him on the program a few weeks ago. His interpretation is interesting, but we want to hear from you because this is, for lack of a better word, this is your sweet spot.
Well, thank you. It's it is definitely in my wheelhouse. Perhaps I should go back to like the 1980s. And it was when I was riding the Giza power plant. And essentially what I was operating on the assumption and the analysis of the Great Pyramid and its features as a machine. It has the precision of a machine. And when you look at the schematics of the interior, it actually looks like a machine. But the as I was working, trying to understand how the machine functioned, it's kind of like if you go out and, you know, say you know nothing about what a jet engine looks like, and you find all these parts lying around, and you put them together, and you're trying to understand all the different features. Well, in this case, it's kind of like a reverse engineering project where I see, okay, this is a machine. How did it function? What are the different elements? How did they work together? And a part of that was the Queen's Chamber. If you go back to Piazza Smythe, who talked about the Queen's Chamber, he had noted that there was salt up to 1 inch thick on caked on the wall, and also that there was a noisome, what he called a noisome odor that came out of the chamber, or that was in the chamber. Similarly, if you go to, say, the Red Pyramid and you go up to the upper chamber, you have a very, very strong smell of ammonia up there. So, you know, the question is, what causes that? Well, in the theory that I had developed on the Great Pyramid, I'd identified the Queen's Chamber as being a reaction chamber where two chemicals were mixed. And the reason I came to that conclusion or posited that theory was that you had the two shafts that were not connected to the chamber until they were discovered in 1874, and before that it was just solid stone, about 5 inches of it. And I was in I bought a property in Indiana, and I was talking to a civil engineer. And I was asking him about percolation tests because living out in the sticks, you know, you have these leach fields for the sewage and all and that, and they do percolation tests to see how many square feet you have to put in. I asked him about percolation of fluids through limestone, and he said, yes, you would need to know what the head pressure is, and you could actually determine quite accurately how much fluid would percolate through limestone. And so I was like, okay, so maybe then this shaft that they discovered actually contained chemicals, and it was leaching through that 5 inches of limestone into the chamber, mixing together and creating what I had theorized was hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why I actually landed on the gas hydrogen. And that the signature for that is in the King's Chamber, in the northern shaft of the King's Chamber. So, you know, all of this is connected. Well, let's get to the issue of the shafts in the Queen's Chamber. The southern shaft was explored by Rudolf Ganterbrink in 1993. And he discovered this so-called door. He calls it a USO, or unidentified stone object, which I think is kind of amusing. But but he had these copper fittings coming through. And at the time, I was sitting with a friend of mine, and he said, oh, those look like electrodes. And I was like, yeah, that exactly. Because if you had a column of water or a column of anything, chemicals or whatever, you would need to know, and you need to know what the head pressure is. You need to have some way of monitoring it. And those would be perfect for monitoring the head pressure on a column of water, a column of chemicals or fluids or anything. And that's on the Southern Shelf. They did another exploration of the Southern Shelf in 2002. And in 2002, they drilled a hole. Before the event, which was hyped, I'm sure you remember.
Sure.
You know, yeah. Before that, it was, I think it was September the 16th. There was a lot of hype, and there were a lot of proposals what might be found behind the so-called Ganterbrink's door. And so, along with others, I proposed, you know, I made my prediction. And went public with it, published it on my website, also appeared on a couple of radio shows, Jeff Rentz, also Coast to Coast with George Noory. And so I said that in order for this to work, it's kind of like, okay, I'm looking at this machine, and I have to have a column of chemicals coming into this fluid coming into this chamber. So the Southern Shaft is filled with these chemicals. How do the chemicals get there? There has to be an inlet shaft somewhere. And so, you know, I was very curious to see if there was an inlet shaft on the other side of the so-called door. And turns out there wasn't. I thought there was for a while, but it turns out that there wasn't. And then after the iRobot explored the Southern Shaft and discovered this space behind the so-called door, they took their robot up the Northern Shaft. And that's where we come to Matt Simpson on the Ancient Architect channel, mm-hmm. who had the gumption to actually do research and find out who was involved in that production, and contacted a person who was actually with National Geographic at the time. Mm-hmm. And the guy evidently was no longer with National Geographic, but there was about 51 screenshots from the robot going up the Northern Shaft that he still had on a hard drive somewhere, or he had it in a file.
Yeah.
And so he sent them to Matt. And then Matt posted his video of that robot going up the Northern Shaft with all the photographs associated with it. And then, you know, I was just blown away, because I was thinking they round a corner and they go around another corner. There's like two bends. They come 96 feet up the shaft. And there on the right-hand side is an opening in the wall.
Yeah, a big opening, yeah.
Right? And so I identified that as the inlet shaft for the chemicals to come in. There's no rule saying that it has to be behind the stone slab or the door. It could be right there. And I got very excited about this. I mean, I had to stop everything. You know, I stopped writing my book to address this, because it was new, it was exciting, and it was exactly what was necessary to prove the theory about the function of those shafts. And it also related to a visit I had in, I think, 2001. Outside of the Great Pyramid, there is, on the east side, there is a vertical shaft in the bedrock. And I had identified that as perhaps an exterior facility that where the chemicals would be stored and monitored and fed into those shafts through those inlet shafts. So I put together a video using the photographs. But also, the really interesting thing was related to the external shaft outside the pyramid. What you see inside the northern shaft is a lot of trash that's been blown.
Yeah, that was really curious. Is those chips of whatever it is, you know, it's weird.
Yes. Well, you know, the thing is that it had site tickets from the 70s in it.
Isn't that strange? Yeah.
And a crumpled piece of paper. And then this little toy car wheel or something, whatever
it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But then in the photographs, they have all this kind of white stuff. You think it might be limestone that's fallen off, you know, the blocks that form the shaft, but if you look at them closely, it looks more like insulation, you know, like foam.
Oh,
foam insulation.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You get a foam, you get a box of goodies and you have all this specially designed foam insulation, you know, but the thing is, when you're looking at those photographs and you're actually going up the shaft, you have to remember that shaft is only like 8 inches high. I mean, it's very small.
Tiny,
you know?
Yeah.
It's tiny. And so this little opening in the side is even smaller. So, you know, if you're looking at like an eight inch tall channel, then that opening is only 4 inches tall, 3 or 4 inches tall. And so whatever's blown in is very small. But when you're looking at it on the camera, it has the appearance of being a lot bigger than what it really is.
But, yeah.
You know, it's very small. And so, you know, you don't see, I didn't see where anything matched with the falling rock from the ceiling or the, you know, sloughed off the walls. But anyway, that was the prediction I made, that there would be an inlet shaft. I was talking about the southern shaft, but then when they also discovered what I call electrodes in the northern shaft, right, with a totally different characteristic, everything matches the theory as far as what the chemicals were.
Right.
Because in the northern shaft, there is a buildup. It's almost like one of those electrodes has been electroplated. You know, the cathode has a coating on it, which it would if you had dihydrated zinc in the shaft, which I proposed in the Giza power plant. And then if you go into the southern shaft, those electrodes have a totally different characteristic. They show a lot of erosion. And the characteristic of the erosion is consistent with the lower parts of the electrode being immersed in the fluid for a longer period of time than the upper part.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the evidence. The evidence comes in through the northern shaft.
Okay. So what would you say that this the opening that we see on the turn is that part of another holding tank? I mean, I was talking to Manu and I had him on the show, and it's like, you know, they scan the pyramid and there's this huge void.
That's a different, totally different area.
It is. Okay. So yeah, it's not anything to do with the void.
It has nothing to do with the void.
Okay.
No.
So what do you say that opening is? Is that just like like you're saying, a possible holding tank for fluids, or who knows?
Well, that opening would be connected to the exterior shaft, the exterior vertical shaft. On the east side of the Great Pyramid, and the debris got into the shaft through that small opening. It was blown in, maybe through a sandstorm or something like that.
Oh,
because, you know,
yeah.
And I think even on the video, some of the photographs, I thought I detected there were some cigarette butts in there.
Well, you know, for a long time, you could actually climb the pyramid. So maybe somebody got up there and, you know, their ticket slipped out of their hand and they went down the shaft.
But if you look down into this vertical shaft on the outside, what do you see? You see trash, right?
Yeah.
You see trash.
Yeah.
Cigarette butts, maybe a psych ticket or two.
All right.
A strong breeze that would carry it up.
So many tourists, it makes sense. So, and there is little dust storms. I've seen them up close and personal. So, yeah. All right. Hey, thanks for that insight, Chris. And
hey, no problem.
Appreciate it. We want to also mention that you are hard at work on your third book, which you're hoping to have finished and released in late 2022, I guess.
I'm hoping earlier, but I think that the publisher would be happy if they would be able to get it in the fall list. So,
okay. All right. Hey, we'll talk to you real soon when this book comes out. We'll have you on the show again. So thanks, Chris.
Okay, Cliff. Good talking to you.
I'm really excited this week. I have a fantastic guest who is going to tell us about women warriors. For over 150 years, we've got this narrative that the Vikings were men who fought their battles and who were the ones who instigated war, who were the fierce warriors, and nothing about women. The women were in the kitchen or held the keys to the doors and to the other aspects. And today we're going to hear from a new author who has written a book called The Real Valkyrie, The Hidden History of Viking Warrior Women. The author is Nancy Marie Brown. And this is a unique book on many, many levels. Not only does it look at the facts archaeologically, but Nancy has done a wonderful job of creating a different narrative and a very important narrative of how these women were part of the society of warriors and the Viking life. Nancy, welcome to Destiny. Great to have you on the program.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
All right. I got to ask you, the book centers around the discovery of a grave numbered BJ581. What got you interested in writing this great book?
Well, actually, I was interested in Valkyries before I heard about this grave, BJ581. My previous book, Ivory Vikings, was about the Lewis chessmen, which is, you know, a very famous chess set. And I argued that they might have been made in Iceland. And Iceland has this tradition of Valkyries, women warriors in the sagas and the Eddas. What I was looking at in that book was, how did these women warriors affect the establishment of the chess queen, which came in at about the same time, at the 1200s, when this chess set was made? And I thought, you know, if it was made in Iceland, the carver would have known about the Valkyries, and maybe that's why, you know, she chose to make the queen so important. It's the first chess set we have that has a queen. So it was like coming up at that time, and I'm thinking, we got warrior women here. But then, if you look at, you know, the standard understanding of the Valkyries, you know, I've studied Icelandic sagas, I've studied Icelandic literature for about 30 years, and we're always told that the Valkyries are goddesses, that they're supernatural, that, you know, there might be shield maids who are legendary, but these weren't real women. And I started thinking, how do we know that? How do we know that there weren't any real women? So I was, you know, putting together all these ideas about, you know, Valkyries, women warriors, shield maids, and I discovered the work of Neil Price, who's a professor at the University of Uppsala and who's written on Valkyries quite a lot. And I arranged to meet him at a conference. And I said, Neil, you're an archaeologist. I would like to actually look at the science behind how do we find out if a buried Viking warrior is male or female. And that might help me in this book that I want to write about Valkyries to say, could there have been some real women warriors in the Viking Age? Or is this totally fantasy? You know, and this is about the same time, about 6 years ago, when the Vikings TV show, you know, came on at History Channel. Yeah. And, you know, we've got this amazing woman, Lagertha, who can beat up all the guys. And, you know, she's like this perfect example of Viking, you know, womanhood. So, of course, I wanted her to be real. But, you know, when I'm writing a book, it's like, I don't want to have the answer before I start. I want to learn these things. So I thought, okay, I'm going to dive into the archaeology, find out how do we know that Viking warriors were men. So I asked Neil Price, I said, can you point me to a grave with lots of weapons in it that we think is a woman? And, you know, who's the archaeologist in charge who I could ask questions of to find out, you know, how did they come to that, you know, conclusion that this could be a woman? Because I knew there are a couple of Viking graves with weapons that they think are female. And you know, there were a couple of things to choose from. Well, he gets this really funny look on his face. This is January 2016. And he says, I can't talk about that yet. And I'm like, okay, I hit a nerve here.
Yeah.
And he kind of thought, said, well, you might want to read this paper, or you might want to go talk to that person. And I thought, I'll just wait. Well, 2017, he and, you know, large group of researchers at Stockholm and Uppsala published this paper, a Viking warrior woman confirmed by DNA. I think it's something like that.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the important word there is confirmed, because what they did was they were studying all of the graves in Birka, which is a town on an island in a lake in Sweden. It's a famous Viking town. So they were studying these bones that are stored in the Swedish History Museum in Stockholm and trying to get DNA out of them. Well, they got DNA out of this one. And this is BJ581. And it's excavated in 1878. So like very beginning of archaeology as a science. It was one of 1,100 graves that were dug up on this island, around the town of Birka in the late 1800s. And it's a very special grave. It's called a chamber grave, which is like an underground house. Mm-hmm. And in this grave, the warrior was buried seated, and they think it might have been on a saddle. There are the bones of two horses in like this separate little anteroom of the underground house. And surrounding this warrior, you have every weapon known in the Viking Age, pretty much. There's a sword. There's a long knife called a skramasax. There's a sheaf of arrows that have a special head on them that's called an armor-piercing arrowhead. There was probably a bow, because there was this blank area next to where the arrows were. Bows are, you know, made of wood and horn and sinew, and they don't last very long. There was an axe. There were two spears and two shields. Mm-hmm. On this warrior's lap, there were a full set of pieces for the board game that's kind of known as Viking chess, Nevatop. And then there was the site of the grave itself. It's on a promontory right near the warrior's hall outside of Birka's fortress. So if you get to this grave, you have to go through the fortress, past the warrior's hall, and there's the grave right on the western tip.
It's a prominent location, isn't
it? Oh yeah,
like a queen's location, the queen.
You would think so, yeah. And there was even this like this big stone marking the grave. So this is this is not just hidden.
Let me just stop you real quickly, because you said something very important. In your book, you describe a number of these very ornate or important grave sites that are a key to an important either warrior, queen, king, or something, and the grave goods. And you just outline there's a number of swords, a shield, two horses in the grave, which means that this was an extremely important person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, horses are really valuable things, you know.
Yeah.
Not everybody got even one. And this person has two of them, and there was stirrups. So obviously there was a saddle. There were two bridles. So these were riding horses, not carriage horses.
Right.
So, you know, this was a very rich grave. The number of weapons, too. I mean, most Vikings that were buried with a weapon got one. You know, they didn't get the whole panoply of weapons. So somebody might be buried with an axe or with a sword, but not every single, you know, weapon known. And these were not fancy weapons. These are not like jeweled and gold and, you know, ceremonial type weapons. These are killing machines.
They're battle weaponry. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, there's nothing pretty about them. So anyway, we have this ultimate Viking burial.
Mm-hmm.
And then these researchers come in and they say, the bones in the middle of that group of weapons are female. And like everybody kind of took a deep breath. And then the questions started coming out. It's like, did you test the right bones? Yes, they tested the right bones. Was there any sign of a male in that grave? No. There was very little clothing, but all the clothing, you know, bits and pieces of, you know, like silver buttons and a silver, you know, little cone for your cap and tiny little bits of silk and an iron cloak pin. All those things are also found in the graves of other male warriors in Birka. So there was nothing female about the clothing, but there was also not enough stuff in that grave for two people. And there was no sign of a man in that grave. Right. So there's,
I mean,
like,
it's wonderful. It's a wonderful a look at this, but right away, you're changing the narrative. Or not necessarily you. The discovery changes the narrative of what historically has been thought of as a male warrior grave. And so what was the impression of the research team or the archaeologists in Sweden when this came out? Were they, and you just kind of hinted that they're saying, isn't there a man in there too? Isn't there a male?
Well, actually, that was their critics. They did every test and they double tested every test. And when they came out with this in 2017, they also looked at the bones and carefully, you know, compare them to other bones of the same, you know, period. And they kind of did look female, even from an osteological point of view.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they published in 2017, they were absolutely sure that this was a woman warrior. This grave has always been defined as the ultimate Viking warrior grave. And now we know that that warrior was a woman. So that's why they titled their paper, you know, Confirmed by DNA, because it had been suggested before that these bones looked female, but now they knew for sure. Well, not everybody believed them. And in fact, the backlash within the scholarly community that really took them by surprise that, you know, other scholars would be questioning their science. The backlash from the scholarly community was so intense that they published another paper in 2019 that went into, you know, a whole lot more depth about what was in the grave and where the position of the grave is and the importance of the gaming pieces and how that, you know, relates to war leaders and mm-hmm. warriors. And, you know, they really like nailed it. I was kind of afraid when that paper came out because I was already well into writing book.
Oh boy.
Oh no, they're going to backtrack. they're going to like give me all these qualifiers.
Yeah.
None of it. No, they were absolutely sure. And I was like, good, we are going to go with this.
That's so great. You, in your wonderful book, describe the Viking society as a martial society, something that is really very important for our listeners to understand. A martial society is inclined or disposed to war. Now, this is something I just discovered in the definition of that. And what you are presenting in this book is that the makeup of their culture, the Viking culture, is to war with your neighbor. It's like you fight I mean, tell us a little bit about the definition and how this society exists and why women are extremely important as warriors.
Well, you kind of have to look at the mythology, the Norse mythology, the mythology of the Viking Age, and you see that war and warriors are absolutely glorified. This was the way to go. They believed that the day of everyone's death was already fixed. There was nothing you can do about when you go. All you could control was how you died, how well you died. And so they wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. One way to do that is to go out fighting and to, this was not the kind of war that we're used to, where you stand hundreds of miles away from the battlefield and push a button, or, fly over it and drop a bomb. No, yeah. This was face to face, your arms against their arms, your skill against their skill. And it was, really considered the, full test of a person, that they would put their life on the line for something they believed in. And that something could be their right to get rich, or their right to live where they want to live, or simply adventure. It was not considered a good thing to just sit at home and wait for life to happen. You went out and seized it. So if you're living in a society like this, that, the way to glory is through fighting, nobody is immune to that. If the idea is that the guys in the next fjord are going to come here and raid your cattle, and you have to, or your sheep, and you have to protect them, then women and children get killed in this too. Houses get burned down. Everybody is at risk. So it makes absolutely no sense to say that we're not going to let women fight because, they're weak and they're pretty and we want to protect them. It's like, no, you're just going to lose them. They're just going to become slaves. So when you're living in a world like that, if you are physically able to fight, you will fight. Mm-hmm. And if you have the ambition to learn to fight, you will learn to fight very well. So again, we can look at the History Channel's Vikings show.
Yeah.
There's this, absolutely beginning, the very first scene is when you have a Viking raid coming into the village and you see all these beautiful women and children, and you're thinking, oh, this is going to be awful. They're going to burn down the houses. They're going to kill everybody. And the camera focuses in on Lagertha, who was classically blonde and beautiful. And she's got little children in the house. She tells them to run and hide, and I'm thinking, oh God, we're going to start with the rape scene. Well, that's not what happens.
Yeah.
Lagertha pulls the poker out of the fire and she beats up these two guys who come into her house. And it is very clear in that scene that these two big thugs cannot handle a highly trained martial artist.
Yeah.
And she's got the moves. Yeah. She doesn't need the size. She has speed. She has skill. She has training.
That's what I want to talk to you about. Cause in the body of your copy of your book, you speculate that both men and women were trained as fighters. And that's really a key point, is that it wasn't just young boys who were raised to fight. You believe in your narrative, and we don't hear about this in any other documents, maybe roughly, or people who have been raided by Vikings, that women are part of the warring clan. And so would you say from a young age, the girls were obviously incorporated and shown how to use weaponry?
There's been a couple of scholars who have done research on warfare and training for warfare in the Middle Ages. And they point out that it wasn't until about the 1100s, well after the Viking Age, that men were taken away from the home to learn to be warriors, that there were these training camps set up. In the Viking Age, this was pretty much a domestic project. You had your local chieftain who would have to put together a war band. And, you know, these people were fed by him, were clothed by him, clothed by his wife. You know, he provided the weapons. It was a very small society, a small group. This was, the training was done, you know, pretty much on a household level. The old people were watching and criticizing. The young people wanted to join in. You know, there were experts there who, you know, weren't on the Viking raid this summer, who would be working with the younger people. And the young people would pretty much self-select, because if you're a young boy and you're constantly getting beat up, you might find a different job. You know, you might find that you don't want to be a Viking warrior. I mean, somebody's got to take care of the animals. Somebody's got to be the overseer. Somebody's got to be the trader. Somebody's got to be the craftsman. If you are a young woman, on the other hand, like the one that was buried in BJ581, who is taller than most people around her, well-nourished, so strong, and probably has a very aggressive outlook on life, and wanted to be, you know, part of that. You know, I kind of think of it like, who becomes an Olympic athlete these days? You know, who joins the Marines these days? You know, there are women who will really push themselves physically, who will really push past pain, who want to do this, who want to, you know, really, you know, try their strength, try their skill. And then, you know, there are boys, obviously there are boys who don't want to do this. So you have to sort of think of, there was a range of people in the Middle Ages, in the Viking Age, just like there is today. They're not all the men are like this and all the women are like that. It's a spectrum. And so instead of thinking about one thing being appropriate for men and something else being appropriate for women, what I think we need to talk about is, one thing is appropriate for people with an aggressive nature, and one thing is appropriate for people with a passive nature.
But let me just
one
stop
thing
you right
is appropriate
there.
For big and the other for small, you know?
Right. But in describing the martial society, isn't it like, you know, yes, there's certain people that are physically able to hold a big sword or an axe or a battle shield. Maybe that's where the shield maiden came from, those women who were, you know, whatever. But if the whole society is developing with this attitude, like we're battle ready, we're battle. Doesn't that mean that the women automatically, even though you may not be very coordinated or whatever, have the ability to hold an axe or hold a sword to at least defend, and in some cases actually become the aggressor?
I would say some of them are better at it than others.
Right.
Certainly you would try. I mean, even now, if you're completely, if you're completely untrained, you're going to try to protect yourself.
Right.
But the ones that would go on the raids, the ones that would become the professional warriors, like what we have buried in 581, they would have to be better than usual. They would have to be extraordinary women. I would think that any woman would be taught to shoot a bow, because that doesn't take a lot of strength, and you can kill somebody very easily with a bow. It's also useful for hunting. Yeah. I would say that every woman learns how to use a knife, because they've got to butcher animals. I mean, if you can kill a pig or kill a cow, I mean, maybe you used a spear to kill your pig. If they can do that, they can kill a man, you know, with some luck. Mm-hmm. So every person in this society would have basic skills that we don't have anymore. You know, they would know how to sharpen a blade. They would know how, you know, to use it, you know, the quickest cut, you know, that would dispatch something. They would have their weapons, you know, in some way.
Why you decided to name her Hervor?
Hervor.
It's a wonderful name, by the way. And talk a little bit about that, because that's who you you create her life.
Right.
Which is wonderful.
Her, yeah. There's a really famous Viking poem that's always been one of my favorites. And in the old masculine view of the Viking world, it's called The Waking of Angantyr. Angantyr is the dead father of Hervor. I and a number of people have renamed this poem the Song of Hervor because she's the hero of this poem. Hmm. She is a warrior woman. She is the leader of a Viking band. She's the daughter of a famous Viking who is killed on an island off of Denmark in a great battle that is sung about, you know, by the bards. And she, the saga tells us, there's a saga about her and her family. The saga tells us that she was as strong as a man. And from her childhood, she would practice more with a bow and a shield and a sword. Then she would spend time learning how to weave and embroider. Mm. And in fact, at one point, her stepfather says, look, you have to be a girl and stay in the weaving room. And so she runs away and she lives by herself as an outlaw in the forest and preys upon travelers, you know, killing them for their stuff, and stays that way until somebody passing through complains to her foster father that there's this outlaw in the woods that you have to get rid of. And he goes and finds out, ah, that's Hervor. Yeah, she's up to no good again. Yeah. At which point he tells her who her father was and that, you know, he was a famous Viking. And she decides she's going to go open his grave and get his sword.
Yes.
And so she goes to her mother and she says, outfit me the way you would do a son. And so she is given, you know, man's clothing and sword and all these things. And she goes off and joins a Viking band. She calls herself by a male name. She becomes the leader of the band. They go to the island in Denmark and everybody else is afraid to go ashore because this, you know, this area where the Vikings were buried has, you know, these burial mounds is haunted. And at dusk, you know, they open up and there's fires that come out and the dead walk. Well, she says, pretty much, I'm not scared of a few flames. So she goes and she opens the grave. She takes out the sword. And in the poem, this is all rather magical. You know, it just sort of opens and she has this dialogue with her father. But as I'm reading this, and I decided to recreate this, you know, in fiction, in the book, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, well, most of the Viking graves that we know of have been opened after, you know, the people were buried and stuff has been taken out. So this was not an unusual thing to do, is to go and retrieve a family heirloom. So what if she just physically opened the grave and, you know, got the sword?
Yeah,
and,
I love
so that's
that.
That's how I write the scene.
No, but I love
it's like
it.
This,
I love
this
it.
Really, you know, incredible portrait in the poem. And yeah. I've tried to reflect that of this, you know, strong woman who is not going to be contained into anybody's stereotype and who goes and she, you know, talks to her father and gets his sword. And the thing that really surprised me about this poem when I read it, you know, over and over again in the original, like kind of stripped away all the translations and looked at the original, is that nobody is surprised she's a woman. When she, you know, fights with the Vikings, when she becomes the war leader, when she goes to the island and people warn her that she shouldn't, you know, she's a fool to go walking around in the graveyard at night. Nobody is surprised that she's a woman. And even her father does not say, you're a woman, you can't have this sword. No, what he says is, you can't have this sword because there's a curse on it.
Right.
And if you take this sword, our family will disappear. Everybody in our family line will die. And she says, why do I care about them? I'm not going to have any sons anyway. So, you know, anyway, so yeah, she's the first Hervor in this book. And then there's another Hervor in the saga who is presented as her granddaughter, but the timing doesn't really work out because there's this other poem that describes her life. And it seems to be reflecting a battle that took place a couple of hundred years before the Viking Age, between the Goths and the Huns. And in this battle, there are two brothers who are fighting for the kingdom. And on the border, you know, the one brother has an army, you know, from the next kingdom. And so there's this border in between. There's a fortress. And the warrior who was assigned to guard this fortress is their sister. So you have another warrior woman, Hervor, who is in charge of an army at a border fortress.
Is that an actual historical event?
This is a poem that scholars think is actually the oldest poem we have from the North.
Okay.
And it does seem to be a historical event. It's very hard for us to say exactly which one, because we don't have a lot of history from like the 600s in, you know, where the Huns were living. But this woman, again, nobody's surprised that there's a woman in charge of this fortress. And she doesn't succeed. She gets killed when the other army, you know, runs over the border. But when her remaining brother sets out to avenge her death, he says, you know, she was happier fighting than most women are sitting on the bench talking to their boyfriends. You know,
it's such a different narrative than what we've been led to believe by anthropologists, archaeologists, is that, and you bring this up throughout the book, is that this Victorian perspective on women being docile, being in the kitchen, being subservient to men, just doesn't cut it in this society, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And you've kind of, you've mentioned the key word, Victorian, because in the 19th century was when our current idea of the Viking Age was created. It's when Viking studies really happened. It's when the texts were translated for the first time, especially into English. It's when it became very popular. This was all caught up with the nationalistic movement in Scandinavia. It was all caught up with, you know, the Enlightenment and the Victorian ideas of what's appropriate for women and what's appropriate for men. It's the same time that archaeology as a science was being developed. So the people who were developing these two fields were men. Women at that time were not allowed to even be educated. So they had this concept that the Viking Age was like their time. And of course, these warrior women that you read about in the stories are like dragons. They're just total fantasy. You know, they can't possibly be real women. And okay, that was a realistic mindset for a man who grew up in the middle of the 1800s and who's only seen, you know, elite women in the kitchen, the church, and taking care of their children. They weren't allowed to do anything else. Well, 150 years later, that no longer flies. You know, I can read those same stories and I can see these women as being totally normal.
Well, let me stop you real quickly there. You bring up a very important point here, is that until your book, the belief was there were no women warriors because of this Victorian stigma that has been carried over for over 150 years.
Yeah, we've held on really tight to it. And there are a couple reasons that it's really hard to break through that kind of a myth. You know, one of them is that it's been in all the textbooks, you know, for hundreds of years. I mean, I learned that when I first started studying, you know, the Vikings in the 1970s, I learned that this society was organized by gender. The women were allowed to do one thing and the men were allowed to do something else. There was a paper I read in the 1990s by a woman named Carol Clover, who argued, I thought brilliantly, that male versus female was not the important way of defining people in the Viking Age, that they were on a spectrum from passive to aggressive. And I thought, okay, 1993, we have fixed that problem. But her her ideas were not universally accepted.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is that we have this concept of the Viking housewife. And, okay, if the Vikings are going off raiding, and if all the men are going off raiding, that means the women are left at home, right, which means the women are in charge of the society, and they're running the farms, and they're very powerful. And if you think of, you know, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, Denmark, it's 10 months of winter and 2 months of growing season. So the person who controls storing and preserving and serving the food is very powerful. You know, they decide who essentially starves. The person who's in charge of weaving and spinning and making cloth for clothing and sails and bedding and all that, that was usually women. They were very powerful because you don't have a cloak, you freeze. If you don't have a sail, you don't go anywhere. So there was a lot of work by often feminist scholars pointing out the economic importance of the Viking housewife.
Right.
The problem is that that kind of closed off all of the other options for women.
Once, right.
Yeah. Once, you know, the feminist scholars in the Viking world, in Viking studies, decided that we were powerful housewives, people stopped looking for, you know, well, were women also fighting? And it just became like, okay, we understand this gender organized society. And then suddenly you have a archaeological study staring you in the face that says there is at least one high-ranking professional woman warrior in the Viking Age. And you know, as the scholars who wrote about this said, we would be very surprised if she was the only one. Okay, yeah. So now we have to rethink this. It's like, okay, I don't want to belittle the importance of the Viking housewife. Obviously, you know, women did have a lot of power at home. But, you know, some of those functions could have been done by men. Yeah. If you look in the sagas, there's a lot of overseers and people in charge of feasts who are men. If you look in the archaeology, as this one archaeologist did, whose work I studied, she did a statistical study of a large number of graves in one graveyard in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And she found that there were more pots and pans in male graves than there were in female graves. And she tested the graves, you know, by, you know, osteology, looking at the bones or DNA to find out, are these male or female?
Yeah.
And the men are buried with the pots and pans. So it's like, who's in the kitchen? How do we know? You know? And that's the big question for me is, how do we know? There's another woman who has done a great study of boats. And that's another thing that's always been associated with men. Men are interested in boats. Women are interested in the kitchen. Well, she found in this one area of Sweden that more women are actually buried in boats than men. Men are buried in carriages. Whereas in Norway, it's always been the reverse. The women are buried in carriages and the men are buried in boats. So we're finding that we don't really know exactly how this worked in the Viking Age. We don't really know exactly what were, you know, the gender options of, you know, men and women. Were women allowed to have boats? Yeah, they were. Were women allowed to fight? Yeah, they were. We don't know how many, you know, and sometimes it might be normal. In some places it might not be.
Yeah.
There's just so much more variation, you know, among the communities in the Viking world than we have taken into consideration.
It's amazing. Talk a little bit about Hervor and your comparison with two important Viking queens who you bring up, the Red Girl and Queen Olga. I don't know about these. These are actual people, but is there any documents that show that these women were in the battlefield or in the raiding field prior to their ascension to queenhood?
Well, you've actually gotten the Red Girl confused with Queen Gunnhild. Yeah, Queen Gunnhild of Norway is really important in this book. She's the person that was Queen of Norway at the time that the skeleton, BJ581, was born and may have actually, right. You know, this girl that I call Herber may actually have been born in the area that Queen Gunhild controlled, that Queen Gunhild actually raided and captured around 930. Queen Gunhild was married to somebody who's right now is a lot more famous, Eric Bloodaxe. Great name. I mean, you can't forget him.
Yeah.
But the sagas tell us, and the sagas were written, you know, a couple hundred years later by Snorri Sturluson, who is not terribly trustworthy as a source, but he's considered a historian. Eric Bloodaxe was one of the sons of King Harald Fairhair. And Harald Fairhair unified Norway, then divvied it up again among his sons. Eric Bloodaxe thought he should be the over king of Norway. So he started killing off his brothers and raiding their lands. But he wasn't very smart. Over and over, the saga makes it clear that the brains behind this operation was Queen Gunhild. And she's called Queen Gunhild, Mother of Kings, because she had many sons and they never fought each other. They never killed each other. They joined together and ruled together with her in what was called the Age of Gunhild for about 10 years in the late 900s. Gunhild was a war strategist. You know, she put together the war plans. She may have actually been on the battlefield.
Wow.
And there's this one, she didn't carry weapons because she is described as being very, very small and pretty. And she was probably pregnant for most of the time
that sounds like
they were fighting this because she had lots of sons. But there's this one, wonderful scene in one of the sagas in Heimskringla, the History of the Kings of Norway by Snorri Sturluson, where this is the death scene of King Haakon, who is her rival for the throne. Mm-hmm. And Snorri says, and I have it here, "It is said by many that Gunhild's servant ran through the crowd shouting, 'Make way for the king slayer,' and shot the arrow at King Haakon. But others say no one knows who shot it." So there's this like strange little hitch in Snorri's, report here that, the boy runs through the crowd saying, "Make way for the king slayer," who, you're expecting this to be Queen Gunhild herself shooting the arrow. And then Snorri says, "But nobody knows who shot it." So there's this like this kind of hint that she might have actually shot an arrow. It's not at all a question, though, that she was a real person. She appears in all of the histories of Norway from that time. And she's in 11 of the Icelandic sagas, always as the villain. She's always, this evil queen, this evil woman that they have to outsmart somehow.
Is that because she's planning war and battles?
Yeah.
Is that why she's evil?
She gets her own way. She doesn't, you either have to, agree to do what she wants or you get kicked out of the country. And she's the sagas are all told from the point of view of the Icelandic hero who goes to Norway to make his name. And if he doesn't, go on the side of Queen Gunhild, then he doesn't survive. And sometimes he's very, very generous to them, gives them ships, helps them on their way. But they all admit that she is the power, on the throne. The other person that you mentioned, the Red Girl is mentioned in an Irish history called The War of the Irish with the Foreigners. And this is like an annal. There's not a lot of detail in this. It's not stories. There's no, quotes or anything. She is listed along with 15 other Viking leaders who were harassing the area of Munster in Ireland in the 10th century. And again, she's just listed along with all these other men as the Red Girl also led her fleet.
When you say harassing, you mean harassing because they want to take their land? They want to...
They were just raiding. They were burning down towns and taking valuable things and capturing people and making them slaves.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're just, Viking raiders, running through this kingdom in Ireland and taking what they want. So she was one of them, you know, devastating this part of Ireland. And then the third historical person that I have her meet, and again, these people were alive at the right time, and it is you know, quite logically possible from what we know about this skeleton and the bones that she could have met these people. The third one is Queen Olga of Kiev. And Kiev at that time was, you know, it's in Ukraine now. It was a large kingdom that was considered, the people were called the Rus, and the Rus were in some way Viking, half Scandinavian possibly, but they were, you know, trade partners of the people in Birka, Sweden. Now, from Birka all the way to Kiev, you find the same types of clothing, the same types of towns, the same types of coins, the same types of you know, all kinds of material culture. So it was this continuous community from Birka, Sweden, all the way to Kiev. And Olga, again, doesn't wield the weapons, but she leads the armies and she devises the strategies. And her story is in the Russian Primary Chronicle. And one of them is how she avenges the death of her husband, which is quite brilliant and quite brutal. The people who of this town, Khorestan, who killed the king, come to her and say, "We'll make it up to you. You can marry our prince." And she says, "Oh, what a wonderful offer. My husband is dead. I'd love to marry your prince. Why don't you bring all your most important men to Kiev and we can celebrate?" And so all the important men come to Kiev, and she says, "Now, you're so important. You can't walk into the city. You can't ride horses into the city. You must be carried in your ship. So tomorrow morning, I will send my bodyguard to pick up your ship and carry it up the hill to the fortress. Yeah, and then I will be showing you the proper honor." And so the next morning, all these pompous men are sitting in their boat waiting to be picked up and carried. And the army comes and they pick up the boat, they carry it up to the top of the fortress, and they drop it in a big hole that she had dug overnight. And she says, "And now we fill the hole, and I will show you the honor to which you are entitled."
Oh, my God.
And so she buries them all alive.
You know, I hear about, like, those kinds of things. I'm like, oh my
great.
God. Brutal. Brutal.
Now, the archaeologists haven't dug that up yet. That's like in the center of the city of Kiev. So we haven't found that yet.
Wow.
We don't know if it really exists. But the next thing she does is she goes to the town of Khorestan and she burns it down. And archaeologists there have found that, yes, indeed, it was burned down at the time that this chronicle says she was, you know, doing this. So there is that much, you know, actual historical basis behind the fact that she was, you know, the queen in charge, and she was very ruthless. So,
you know,
she's another interesting person that we really need to know about.
You make a great case for not just Sweden in the Viking Age of being this martial society. Perhaps all of Europe had this.
Oh yeah, definitely.
We're never told this.
Because it was not.
It didn't follow the narrative that the
Victorians. It was not,
you
know, politically correct for the Christian monks who were writing the histories.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
Later in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, the Christian monks.
you have
our historians.
Right. You have to remember who was writing down the stories and, you know, what their opinion of women was and how they might have been reshaping, you know, some of these stories. So the first thing you have to do when you look at medieval texts is to peel away some of the obvious biases. And, you know, the Christian versus pagan outlook is something really important to keep in mind. The fact that we haven't heard of them recently is just because the people who are reading and translating these texts still have some of those same biases. Mm-hmm. And so they just assume, again, that these women are as mythical as dragons, and they don't, you know, put a lot of effort into telling us about them.
Wow. The book is The Real Valkyrie, The Hidden History of Viking Warrior Women. My guest has been Nancy Marie Brown, I have one last question for you in the time we have remaining. Why is it important that she is sitting in her grave? Is that the distinction of a ruler or an important individual rather than laying in the coffin or the grave? She's sitting.
We really don't know.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Every major Viking grave that's been excavated seems to be different. In some they're sitting, in some they're lying, in some they're in a bed, in some they're in a boat, some have horses, some have ships. The more graves are dug up, the more confusing it becomes to decide, how do we decide what is normal? In this case, the fact that she is sitting, she has all the weapons just sort of laid out around her, and mm-hmm. she may actually have been holding one of the spears in her hand. It's kind of angled in a way that would be possible. So it might have been just to show her martial ability, but we really can't be sure. There are other graves in Birka that are sitting, but they're not all of them.
And I guess the last question I have for you is, obviously, if she was a queen or a dignitary of some kind, she would have had, she does have some kind of a marker, which is a stone. But mm-hmm. After you've written this book, do you have any new sense of her importance with the community?
I don't think
a chieftain or something.
No, I don't think she was a queen. There's nothing really valuable in her grave.
Okay.
She was a war leader. She was the one who fought and made the strategy. She might have been the person in charge of the fortress at Birka.
Oh, right.
She was in charge of the fighting. Yeah, she was the general. She wasn't the queen. She was the leader, the war leader.
Wow. Nancy, fantastic book. Much success. And I hope we hear more from you. I before we started, I was mentioning this is a perfect book or an article follow-up for National Geo or Smithsonian, simply because more people need to hear about it. So, hey, continued success.
Thank you very much.
It really does remain to be seen if National Geographic, the Smithsonian Institute, or any other orthodox publication picks up on what Nancy has presented here. A completely different perspective of the women from the ancient past, from the ancient Viking community. As we heard from her, Nancy, there's likely numerous graves that are from battle-tested women, women who encountered and fought valiantly with the Vikings, died in battle, and were honored along with men in these grave sites in Sweden. I am waiting to get some photographs of the gravesite. Nancy said she would send it to me and post them on the Facebook page, just because I was fascinated not only by the grave goods, but why certain individuals that they uncovered were sitting, a seated position. You have to wonder if that's an honorary distinction for them to be sitting in that, to be in a sitting position. Hard to say. Really hard to say. But here we go. Another paradigm-bending discovery that we don't know anything about. And I was lucky to have a publicist for St. Martin Press send me a release and then eventually a book, the book, on the Valkyrie and get them on the program. It was such a great fit. I was like, well, thank you. Perfect. Send others. By the way, you can get the book on Amazon. It's available for under $20 or your favorite local bookstore, wherever you're located. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ancients, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you can support the work we do here on the program. And as much as we love doing it, we do have expenses and they are increasing. So to become a subscriber, go to Patreon, that's patreon.com/Earth Ancients. We have a ton of gifts for you. We have 15 ebooks from many of the authors we have on the program here. We have a couple of galleries. We have some unpublished interviews. And each month we have conversations with Cliff, a chance to sit down and I kind of tell you what's going on. You can ask me some questions. But a lot of the photographs that I would normally publish on the website, I keep simply because I'm using them for books or I've been restricted from using them in public. We go through those photographs. We go through videos. We do the presentation, the conversations with Cliff on Zoom, which is very versatile, and we can show a whole bunch of stuff. So please consider becoming a subscriber. $5, $10, $15, even $20 a month is hugely helpful. And to become a subscriber, go to patreon.com/earthancients. So I want to thank the following people for subscribing in the month of August. I want to thank AJB, Caitlin Nitteker, Robert Diamond, Tom Evans, and Robert Keller. And you guys rock. You guys make it happen. So thank you. Hey, that reminds me, we're in our final few weeks before we leave for Mexico, October 7th through the 17th. This is going to be amazing. We're going to see the largest pyramids in the Americas, as well as some of the most unforgettable museums. And we're going to have Marco Vigato with us to show a amazing slide presentation on megalithic Mexico, which is based on his new book on Atlantis, which comes out next year. We'll also see Mount Albán in Oaxaca, Teotihuacan. It's an amazing tour. And would you believe it's half off? This is normally around $5,000 for a 10-day tour. It's half that much. So this is a real great opportunity to come out. For more info, go to earthancients.com/tours, and you'll see all the details. It's really not one to be missed. Also, while you're there, you can see our Egypt tour. This is a diplomatic VIP tour. We just released it a few weeks ago, and now it is available. That's May 3rd through the 15th. And that is going to be one for the book, simply because we're going to some places we haven't gone to before. So Earth Ancients tours are archaeological tours, but we also get into the subtle energies. And I teach everybody how to tap into, or as I call it, plugging into ancient sites. So check it out, earthancients.com/tours. Okay, that's it for this week. I want to thank my guest today, Nancy Marie Brown, Chris Dunn. It was good to see Chris and hear from him. Our regular staff, Bruce Fenton, Ruth Thomas, and our editing and art team is wonderful. All right, that's it. Take care, be well, and we'll talk to you next week.